The LARB Radio Hour is a free weekly podcast of the Los Angeles Review of Books, a reader-supported nonprofit publication. To support our continued work on this show, in print and online, please consider donating or joining as a member today at lareviewofbooks.org/radiohour. Hello and welcome to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported LA Review of Books. I'm your host, Kate Wolfe, and I'm joined by my co-host, Eric Newman.
Hi, Kate.
Hi, Eric. And this week, we're listening to an interview that I did with the sociologist Gretchen Sisson about her new book called Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood.
Yeah, so I'm curious to hear about this conversation because, you know, we've talked before about how my perspective on adoption is I wish more people would adopt. And I, you know, that probably won't necessarily change, but I feel like this book offers a different perspective on kind of both the politics and the adoption system. So, you know, could you just tell me a little bit about what the book, kind of what its perspective is?
Yeah, I think this book, without saying it's anti-adoption, it's certainly looking at the complicated repercussions of adoptions on birth mothers and their children, specifically looking at women who gave up their babies. So less about adopting older children out of the foster system, more about women who decided, you know, while they were still pregnant, that they probably couldn't care for their child, and most of them already had children. And a lot of times it was a very small margin of money that would have made the difference to have them be able to raise their children, but they, you know, they couldn't get it. And it also kind of looks at the policing of poverty in families, and especially of women of color. And, you know, sometimes asking for more assistance made people afraid because they didn't want the foster system to come in and take away the children they had.
Yeah, yeah. They're proving you couldn't take care of a new child potentially put you at risk for being identified as someone who couldn't take care of all of your children.
Exactly. And I think this is, the book is especially topical at the moment because of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And during those hearings in the Supreme Court, the suggestion that, you know, abortion wasn't necessary because of the possibility of adoption and relinquishing a baby. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, if you have that option, you know, you don't really need to have an abortion. And this book is kind of...
which is again, by the way, to pretend that either of these options are just like kind of easy to take.
Totally.
I think is a perspective only a man could have.
Well, actually, it was Amy Coney Barrett who said that. And, you know, not surprisingly, because she is involved in this evangelical Christianity or whatever, she's into something extreme. And that Gretchen's book also looks at the connection between Christianity, these Christian organizations, and private adoption agencies, and kind of the history of it. But certainly that, you know, I remember hearing that and thinking, what is she talking about? Like, it's not easy just to go through a pregnancy and then give up the baby. Like, it's in no way parallel to having an abortion. I was blown away. The idea beyond, you know, I was thinking of it more of like the weird social stigma of being at work and being pregnant and then suddenly like you don't have a baby at the end and that's a big deal. But I think this book really looks at the emotional toll of, it's heartbreaking to go through a pregnancy and then give up the baby. And it's just not a light thing. And it really, and it features all these interviews with mothers. And it's not, you know, per se, it's not coming down strictly against adoption, but I think it's looking at this whole ecosystem of reproductive justice and how these things are intertwined and how possibly it could be a more, you know, equitable playing field overall. And so certainly having all options open helps with that. And when you shut down a whole avenue of options, things get funkier than ever. So it was a very interesting conversation and important.
I can definitely be on board with that. I can both be pro-adoption and also know that we need to reform our adoption system.
Yes, exactly. That is another part of the argument.
Well, I can't wait to hear this interview.
Great. Let's listen.
Thank you.
I'm glad to be speaking with the sociologist Gretchen Sisson today. Gretchen Sisson studies abortion and adoption at Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. She's with me to speak about her first book, Relinquished: The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. The book is based on interviews Sisson conducted over the last decade with birth mothers who relinquished their children for private adoption in the U.S. Most often, Sisson found that these women deeply regretted their decision and that poverty was the driving force behind it. Alongside the harrowing stories of the women who Sisson spoke with, her book also looks at the history of adoption in the United States and its ties to conservative Christianity, as well as family policing systems of the state. In an age of narrowing reproductive freedom, when adoption is touted by the Supreme Court as an answer to the need for abortion, Relinquished asks hard questions about the compatibility of the practice with the possibility for true reproductive justice. Thank you so much, Gretchen, for being here.
Thank you, Kate.
So I wanted to start with how you came to write this book. You're a sociologist and you did your master's thesis on infertility treatments, but you write at the same time you were interning at an Alliance for Teen Pregnancies and you were also volunteering for an abortion fund hotline. And you write that you saw all these things, all these types of work kind of in parallel and as critical efforts to, quote, support people in having families they wanted to on their own terms. So what led you to write about adoption in particular?
So in all of these sorts of areas where I was doing work, and this was at the end of my graduate school, my time in graduate school, you know, I kept coming up against this idea of adoption as a panacea, as it were. I was working at the abortion, volunteering with the abortion fund, and I would get calls from people who wanted to have abortions and couldn't afford them, and helping them figure out how they could afford their abortions. We did grant making to make sure people could keep their appointments. And as you mentioned, I just finished my master's thesis on infertility that was interviewing people that were trying to figure out how they were going to build their families when they were faced with troubles conceiving. And I was working with these young parents at the Alliance on Teen Pregnancy. And at the time, they were doing a lot of policy work around ensuring that the Commonwealth was supporting its vulnerable families with housing, childcare, you know, changing the pregnant and parenting student policy at Boston Public Schools so that they could continue their high school educations. And I kept seeing the ways that adoption was used to, quote, solve all these problems, that we don't need to provide access to abortion if adoption is available, right? If people who are struggling to find ways of building their families, like they should just adopt. Rather than lobbying for public support, these young and vulnerable families should just relinquish their children and give them to middle-class families, right? And that is the way that we're going to solve all these problems. And again, problems is in quotes, right? Because I don't actually think these are problems. But there's sort of this refrain that they are. And that if we just take babies from these families over here and give them to these families over here, that we have averted the need to be accountable to the way we're taking care of people and children in our society.
But, you know, so despite the fact that adoption is kind of seen as the solve-all, it's actually a very, very small part of the story in terms of actual numbers. I was wondering if you could kind of give us a sense of the numbers. Maybe, you know, I know that this book takes place over, you interview people over a decade. So whatever current, you know, as current as you have. And also, since it is such a small part of what people actually do, you know, there's lots of births, there's lots of abortions, but it's fractional how many adoptions there are. Again, why is this such a big part of the story? Or why is this seen as such a cure-all when it's something that so rarely even takes place?
So there are about 4 million births in the country every year. Over the 20-year span that this book looks at, there are between 850,000 to 1 million abortions per year. And right now there are about 18 to 22,000 private domestic infant adoptions per year. Now, I want to contextualize that a little further because you'll see a lot of different numbers for the adoption number. And that can include things like foster care adoptions. And actually the most common type of adoption in the United States is a step-parent adoption. So if I'm widowed or divorced and I get remarried and my new partner decides to adopt my children, that's the most frequent form of adoption that we see. That is, of course, very, very different than legally severing a child entirely from their family of origin and creating a new family. You know, so what I wanted to look at, particularly in this book, was domestic infant adoption, because I was coming at the question from one of reproductive justice and reproductive politics and looking at how adoption is framed in that way. So I did kind of narrow it down to this sort of subset of adoption that I think takes a particularly outsized rhetorical importance to get to your question, because it is a relatively small number of people. And so many more people will be choosing abortion when faced with a crisis pregnancy. And what I found really is that most of these women that I interviewed weren't interested in abortions at all. And most of them continued their pregnancies with the intention of parenting. And it was when parenting then felt untenable that adoption kind of became the lifeline for them. And so I think that not only is the political conversation around birth mothers and around adoption outsized and misplaced in some ways, but it is just particularly not accountable to the people that are most impacted.
And those people being the mothers.
Yes.
Who are giving up their children.
Yeah. The mothers and the adopted children and the adopted people. And I try to be careful about saying children because they don't stay children forever, right? So adopted people live with the consequences of their adoptions over the course of their lives as well. My book particularly focuses on the birth parents and what adoption means for them, the context in which those adoptions occurred, and how well adoption does or really doesn't serve them over their lifetime.
And it seems like a important distinction you make between people who would be seeking abortions versus those who are really choosing between parenthood and adoption. Because we saw that come up a couple years ago almost now with the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade and this idea that, oh, instead of an abortion, you would just have the baby and then adopt it. That was Justice Coney Barrett's idea that, of course, it's not an undue burden to ask a woman to go through a pregnancy and then adopt her child, you know, or right. have her child adopted by someone else.
Right. Well, this idea that being forced to continue a pregnancy and then terminating your parental rights, I think her quote was averting the burden of parenthood. You can deny someone access to abortion in her mindset and still not be imposing parenthood on them. That's just not what we have found to be true. I mean, first of all, most people who are seeking abortions are entirely uninterested in adoption. And it's not that they don't know about adoption. People know adoption exists. They have really high levels of adoption knowledge, but they have very low levels of adoption interest. And in one survey of abortion patients, they were asked to rate, you know, a series of true-false statements. One of the statements was, I'm interested in placing this baby for adoption rather than having an abortion. And 99% said no. 99% just said no. 0% said true. One said kind of. So the just interest in adoption is incredibly low among abortion patients. Now, when you deny people access to abortion, that number goes up because these are people who are really highly motivated to avoid pregnancy and parenthood. But we still found that the vast majority of people who are denied access to the abortions that they want, these are people who showed up on the day to get an abortion and they were not able to get care, 91% of them were parenting the children that were born to those pregnancies. Only 9% were relinquishing those babies for adoption. Now, the 9%, and I had a conversation with my colleague, Dr. Diana Green-Foster, who is the principal investigator for kind of this broader turnaway study that looks at this. And she says, well, why is the 9% so low, right? Because she's comparing it to this 91% of people who are parenting afterward. And she would have thought that more would have considered and chosen adoption. And I said, 9% is so dramatically high, right? Because you had basically none of them who were interested in this if they were able to access their abortion care. And we also know that of births, this is less than half a percent of all births. So it just shows that when you constrain people's choices, when you remove options, when you make abortion impossible to get, you will increase the number of adoptions for sure. But what you will increase much more dramatically is the number of people parenting children that they did not intend to have at that time. And I think that that is one thing we fundamentally misunderstand, that most people who are denied access to abortion are going to be raising children. the adoption remains a minority even in that group.
I'm curious for you what it was like to see adoption enter the conversation so much around Dobbs. And in your book, you were saying that also in Justice Alito's, in his notes about, you know, his decision.
The domestic supply of infants. Yes. Yes. I mean, both Justice Coney Barrett and Justice Alito were very concerned about adoption. And it's a little bit funny because I had done data collection on this for a really long time. And I was kind of working on a book proposal and I didn't know if this was going to be an academic book or what quite it was going to look like. And my husband and I were listening to the Dobbs oral arguments on that December morning. And we hear Justice Coney Barrett, you know, asking these questions. And my husband turns to me and goes, "You should probably send out your book proposal soon," I would say. So, and I think that what the Supreme Court decision did, as far as the book is concerned specifically, is it took what could have been a really academic question and made people understand how adoption intersects more broadly with their ideas of reproductive rights and justice. And so, you know, obviously don't wish this decision had not happened, right? I believe it's dangerous for the American people. But at the same time, if it's going to happen, I'm glad that it is bringing more scrutiny to this institution that I have been studying for so long. But to get back to your question, I mean, we talked about Justice Coney Barrett and this idea that adoption, you know, averts the burden of parenting, which it doesn't. But also the footnote that Justice Alito cites in the decision is basically, and this is a paraphrase, basically saying that mothers who don't want to parent, they don't need to worry because there are so many people who want to adopt, right? We have a very low supply of infants available. And that's true. And this is actually a myth that we have about adoption in the United States, that we need more people who are willing or wanting to adopt. Now, we don't track these things, but the best estimates suggest that there are between 10 and 45 waiting families for every infant that's relinquished for adoption. So we have very, very, very high demand, as Justice Alito cites, and very, very low supply. And I talk about it in these market terms because I think it's important to recognize the ways that adoption is a market, and that when you have attorneys, agencies, facilitators, other players in this space, they are trying to meet a really high market demand. And they are, in a lot of ways, motivated to facilitate adoption, to promote adoption as a solution to people who would otherwise not be interested in it at all.
I see. Yeah, you talk about the geotagging that takes place when people visit these Planned Parenthoods, you know, that suddenly they'll be getting ads for adoptions and kind of barraged with this advertising.
And it's not just Planned Parenthoods and abortion clinics. You know, they'll do geofencing on methadone clinics, on drug treatment facilities, on like WIC locations, other places of family support. So, you know, your phone knows everything about you usually. And so if you're pregnant and you're going to one of these places, then you're going to start getting targeted advertising for adoption agencies, because what they're really doing is trying to find pregnant people who are in a vulnerable place, right? Who might be dealing with homelessness, might be struggling with addiction, or might just be living in poverty, as so many millions of American families do, right? So you can have acute crises, but you can just have kind of this normal everyday struggle that so many American families are living with. And they're going to get really targeted for adoption. And it's not just physical geotagging, but a lot of times agencies or prospective adoptive parents will buy keywords. So if you're Googling, you know, support for single moms in California, you might start to get ads for adoption agencies as well. So they do virtual geofencing as well.
You know, I want to get into your research, but I also, you know, you bring up a little bit in the earlier part of the book, the history, the dark history of adoption in this country, or kind of the origins of it as being in slavery, being in Native Americans separated from their parents. Could you talk a little bit about some of that?
Yeah. And I think it's important to recognize that adoption as we currently practice it, right, with this permanent legal separation from one family and movement to another, that is a relatively historically recent phenomenon. It is at its longest, like 120 years, let's say, old. And a lot of those practices as far as like the secrecy, the sealing of birth certificates around adoption, that came like directly out of child trafficking, actually. And Georgia Tan, who was in Tennessee, she ran the Tennessee Children's Home. She developed a lot of these practices. And that's really the origins of a lot of the ways that we legally practice adoption today. And a lot of the reasons why a lot of adopted people in the United States still don't have access to their original birth certificates was because of a lot of the lobbying and the work that she did to really maintain a high, high level of secrecy around adoption. But I think if you look at family separation more broadly and the ways that private adoption today fits into that, I mean, you can see the ways that family separation in the United States has largely happened, and speaking broadly, for one of two reasons, right? It's used as a way to police and punish certain communities, right? And that's where we see family separation of enslaved families. That's where we see the forced removal of Native American children from their tribes in boarding schools, and then later through the Indian Adoption Project, right? These programs were not about meeting a market demand for children, but they were about punishing, policing, and extracting obedience from their parents and their families. And I think that you see a lot of echoes of that today in our child welfare system, and the way that our child welfare system polices disproportionately Black families today. The other sort of thread is the market demand for children that drives family separation. And this is really about this ongoing demand, as I've mentioned, for children and historically for white children. And that's why, if you look back at pre-Roe v. Wade, most private adoption was so predominantly white. And even into the 80s and 90s, you saw very low participation from women of color in the private adoption system. Now, I think what we're seeing today is kind of a convergence of both of these threads in a lot of ways, as the private adoption system and the family policing system are kind of increasingly entangled, and family policing is used as a way to facilitate private adoptions. Private adoption is framed as this empowering alternative to interacting with the child welfare system for some of the mothers that I interviewed. That did not serve them well in the long term. And I think a lot of this is from really a progressive and left of center participation in the private adoption system that views transracial adoption, for example, as this post-racial practice. And so now you can have white families, whereas in the 60s and 70s, you had almost no white families that were willing to adopt Black children. Today you do. And however they are made available for adoption, families are willing to take in children of color in a way that they haven't been or weren't. And as a result, you see poverty making mothers and families vulnerable to family separation through both of these threads. So poverty makes people more vulnerable to family policing and foster care removals, but poverty is also a determining factor now in making mothers more likely to consider private relinquishment. So again, if you look back pre-Roe v. Wade, the white girls and young women that were relinquishing their infants kind of in the maternity home, the girls who went away era, that was about delaying motherhood, right? It's you are not married, you are too young to be a mother, so this baby, you're going to place this baby for adoption, and then later, when you're in some sort of socially acceptable situation for parenting, then you can parent. What we're seeing now are a lot of mothers who already have children that they're raising, and they can't afford one more child, or they can't afford the first child, or they don't have some sort of safety or stability. It's kind of that breaking point. So again, and I'm speaking in very broad strokes because it's a very long and complicated history, but I think it's important to understand the way these two threads really interact with each other now, and the ways that they both contribute to making families vulnerable to separation.
I was curious, and you know, there's a few examples in your book of people maybe who were, you know, had housing precarity and they were pregnant and living on the street or partly in jail. And then they decided to do an adoption. And suddenly this adoption company was like putting them up in an Airbnb while they were carrying the child. And I was wondering if any of your research looked at like what available resources women in poverty who are carrying children have from the state versus like what adoption companies are offering them. Like, how much sweeter is the deal, basically, if you're going through a private agency than if you're going through the state versus what you can receive in assistance?
Oh, I mean, again, all the mothers that I interviewed for this book did relinquish. And like, so the question is, well, what about those mothers that were in a vulnerable place and didn't? Like, where were they able to get help? What did that look like? But a lot of the mothers that I spoke with, like, they were trying to get off lists for public housing, right? Or food assistance, or food assistance they could usually get. Housing was really the big one for them. And so those lists are long. It's hard to find ones where they could have their children. So some homes will only take women, or, you know, only take children over a certain age. But to find a home that would take a mother and a baby, that was very challenging. And they would be on these lists and they just couldn't get access to housing before the baby was born. Adoption agencies are really quick at getting people housed if they need to. And some of them are really aggressive. You know, you'll see certain agencies are actually really known for this because they have homes and they'll say, yeah, well, if you're willing to come out here, to fly out here, like, we have housing for you. We have a dorm for you right away, and, you know, whenever you need it. But what that movement also does is it separates the mother from her community. So if she has any support, any friends, even if it's thin, right, even if they're not able to do like tangible support for her, it removes her from that circle, from that network. And it also means, say, for example, if she's on a housing wait list here in California and she relocates to Utah, she's off that housing list, right? Because she's no longer a California resident, for, you know? And so I think that this movement of people for housing, one, obviously much faster within the private adoption system than actually relying on the public safety net. But it can also be a displacement that makes people more vulnerable as well. The immediate need of housing is met, and I'm not minimizing that, but that can also serve the agency's longer aim of trying to ensure that the adoption does occur.
You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour. I've been speaking with Gretchen Sisson, author of Relinquished. We'll return to that conversation in just a moment, but first we have this week's book recommendation.
We're excited to have Brad Gooch back with us on the line today. Brad is the author, most recently, of Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Haring, and he joins us today for this week's book recommendation. So Brad, what book are you recommending?
I am recommending Cynthia Carr's Candy Darling, which I've been reading about the Warhol superstar and, you know, the kind of celluloid, silvery presence in 60s and 70s in New York City. And I'd sort of forgotten about Candy Darling, and she sort of remained the residue of a Lou Reed lyric that she was in, and some idea of her as kind of like Kim Novak. Along comes Cynthia Carr and revisits her, and then you realize, well, of course, she was trans, and she was dealing with issues of gender and identity, and how was she doing it? And so it's just very interesting to have our sensibility in that sense, looking back at Candy Darling, and certainly the glitter of it, but also that here was this kid from Long Island who was having gender dysphoria and looking for love. And, you know, all of this, we have a language even for this experience now that didn't exist when she was alive and she was going through it. I knew Jackie Curtis some at the time, and Jackie Curtis was a different phenomenon, because sometimes he would show up as Jack Curtis. I mean, you know, sometimes he was dressed as a guy, sometimes he was dressed as a girl. And, you know, it was obvious he was a poet, and it was a kind of performance art in that way. And Candy Darling was never separate from the screen in some way. I mean, no matter where she went, she was always that person 24/7. And then, you know, it was a different kind of high wire act, and has a kind of tragedy to it. So I just really enjoyed having Candy Darling brought back, and also allowing her to reinvent herself and to deal with the ways in which she had gender dysphoria, but she also had kind of blonde gender euphoria. I mean, you know, she found a way to to deal with all this that was fun, and that, you know, raised the frequency of all our lives.
That sounds fascinating. Do you have any Did you have any early memories or encounters with Candy Darling, or is that kind of a different, maybe slightly different?
Yeah, it was different. People would tell me, I mean, I remember Edmund White talking about like being on the dance floor all night with Candy Darling, which was very impressive to me. But she died in 1974. I came to New York in 71 and wasn't plugged in enough as a student at Columbia College to get to hang out with Candy Darling. But, you know, so that's why also in my mind, she's always on the screen. I mean, even that was just my sense of her is like moving in 2D through our life. So it's nice to get a 3D version. Yeah.
That sounds wonderful. Can you give us the title and author one more time?
The title is Candy Darling. It has a fuller title that you would have to check. And Cynthia Carr. Cynthia Carr also wrote a biography of David Winorowicz called The Fire in the Belly a few years ago, which is also great.
Which is excellent. So I'm very much then looking forward to the Candy Darling biography as well. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Brad Gooch, author most recently of Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Haring.
You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour. We now return to our conversation with Gretchen Sisson, author of Relinquished. Talk about a little bit about the, you say that the baby snatching era, which is really like unbelievable, some of the, you just get into a little bit, but some of what occurred with the lies that mothers were told about what happened to their children and, you know, yes, the secrecy and privacy around identity and all these things. So that has changed to now a more policy of open adoption. What is that transition? How is the open adoption different from the private ones of the past?
So first, as I mentioned earlier, like Georgia Tan, I mean, she just straight up stole children. And there are so many accounts of her being at a delivery, telling mothers their babies had died, and then she would go sell them for adoption, right? So there's those practices that were kind of early 20th century. And then there's the baby scoop era that we look at, and it's usually dated from the end of World War II, so like the beginning of the baby boom, until Roe v. Wade in 73. And this was really the era of maternity homes, where girls would be sent away from their families. This is all very secret. These adoptions were deeply coercive, and they were entirely closed. So the mothers didn't have any information about their child, where they were going. Sometimes they weren't even allowed to hold the baby after the baby was born. And then they were told, like, okay, go back to your life and get married and have a baby when it's appropriate for you to do so. And like, obviously, these were all deeply, deeply traumatizing adoptions. And they didn't remain closed, right? Because now anybody can go on 23andMe and find genetic relatives. And so they still are. They're still finding each other. And a lot of the mothers that I interviewed that had adoptions at that time, they're not included in this book, but they were interviewed and they had found their children at some point. After Roe v. Wade, the domestic adoption rate dropped pretty quickly and pretty profoundly. And, you know, by the end of early 80s, you had relatively few American women relinquishing compared to what they had like in the 60s at that time of really coercive adoptions. Adoption agencies then start offering more open adoption. So you can choose the parents, you can get pictures, right? And framing adoption more as something that you can choose. This is kind of this empowered option for you and offering that. And that ensured some level of participation from young white women, kind of the same women who would have been sent to a maternity home 10 or 15 years earlier. Their families would really push them into this. But then by the 90s, that's when you start to see the uptick in international adoption. And that's when that really became the more common kind of adoption in the United States, was the importing of children from foreign countries. That did a couple things. One, it normalized transracial adoption in some ways that we hadn't happened when adoption was mostly domestic. And it also meant that agencies that did want to work with American birth mothers needed to offer more, needed to find other ways of making adoption appealing. And I want to be clear, openness in adoption is better than having a closed adoption. So as a harm mitigation measure, it's very clear. And actually the person best served by openness in adoption is the adoptee. And we tend to think of open adoption as a favor to the birth parent, but actually a lot of the mothers I spoke with who had some level of open adoptions, like they're dealing with their own trauma. Like, it's hard for them to be in contact with their child. They want to be. They want to have a relationship with their child, but it can be painful. And the person, again, who benefits the most is the adoptee as they grow, because it's good for them to know where they came from and to have that connection. But the mothers that I interviewed would say, I mean, I think most of them would say, at least at the beginning, that they had an open adoption. But that's not one single coherent thing. So some mothers would be like, I have an open adoption because the agency sends me pictures twice a year, right? And some mothers would say, well, I'm in an open adoption and like I'm babysitting my child like once a month, or I'm going on family vacations, right? So you have this tremendous spectrum of contact that may or may not be mediated by the agency, may or may not happen directly between the adoptive family and the birth parents, and can change a lot over time. So there were many mothers that I spoke with who had a certain high level of contact soon after the adoption was finalized, and then it tapered off for, you know, some logistical life reasons. Someone moved across the country, families get busy, and they were just unsatisfied with the amount of contact that they had for that. And for some, it was like an intentional closing or limiting of contact on the part of the adoptive family. Or in some cases, the mothers themselves had to pull back because of the emotional struggle that they went through to be in ongoing contact with their child. Again, because it was painful to continually separate. So open adoption is not a single thing. In most states, it is not legally enforceable. And I think that that's really important to understand. And Melinda Seymour, who's a legal scholar in Texas A&M, she's done a lot of work on adoption agencies that market open adoption, use open adoption as a way of making adoption appealing to pregnant people when they are operating in states that don't have legally enforceable open adoption, right? And not even just legal enforceability. But I mean, open adoption is a complicated relationship, right? It's the norm within adoption, but it's kind of an oddity, an odd relationship in broader society. And so I think that it requires ongoing support, counseling, negotiation, and a lot of agencies will sell openness, but aren't equipped to actually ensure that these relationships are meaningfully executed lifelong.
And a lot of times it seems like it's just in the hands of the adoptive parents, you know, after a certain amount of time,
course.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, and because, you know, once an adoption is finalized, the child has no legal relationship whatsoever with their birth family. And it is entirely the discretion of the adoptive parents who they want to be involved in their child's life.
And there's no legal recourse. I noticed that the 48 hours... you have 48 hours to rescind your decision, or how does that work in terms of what legal rights the birth parent has?
That varies a lot by state too. So for some states, the revocation is very, very, very short, you know, 24, 48 hours after signing papers. In some states, it is much longer. And I think that there's challenges with that as well. Once you've signed the papers, once you don't have custody of your children, physical custody of your child, even if you change your mind, it can be hard. And there's an organization called Saving Our Sisters that's sort of this coalition of birth mothers and adoptees that aim to work with mothers who have signed their papers already but are interested in reclaiming their children within their revocation window. And sometimes that's quite a legal challenge. And a lot of birth parents can't afford attorneys. They can't afford a legal battle. And a lot of adoption agencies and a lot of adoptive parents can. And so you can challenge a revocation within that narrow window, but it is surprisingly difficult in a lot of states.
Talk about the women that you spoke with for the book. Maybe give me a sense of how many people you talked to, and it was over a decade, and the prevailing feeling among them about their decisions to go through with adoption.
So I did interviews in 2010 and then in 2020. And But the adoptions in the book are all from 2000 to 2020. So they cover 20 years of adoptions, 10 years of data collection span. And many, all of the mothers from 2010, I re-interviewed again in 2020 to see how their feelings about their adoption had changed over time. And I think that most of the, you know, almost all of the mothers, even mothers who might otherwise feel positively about the adoption, talked about like this really immediate mourning grief period that happens right after the adoption and that separation at first. Then a lot of them talked about kind of this adoption honeymoon window that happens kind of once they get through that initial grief. And mothers that are in that place, one, they're usually in similar circumstances to where they were at the time of the adoption, right? So if they're struggling with homelessness, maybe they still are, right? If they're in an unsafe relationship, maybe they still are, right? Like whatever sort of circumstances led them to relinquish in the first place are more likely to be true just because they're closer to the adoption. And so that might make the adoption feel more necessary, but they're also feeling really optimistic. This is going to be a really open adoption. Maybe they're happy with the contact that they have with their child. A lot of them are like almost infatuated with their child's adoptive parents in a lot of ways because they see the lives they're living as really aspirational. And so they're still sort of living in this space where what the agencies have told them still feels very, very true. Over time, a lot of them came, almost all of them came to a far more critical space of understanding the adoption. And that could happen for a number of reasons. Contact stopped. Contact was limited. Contact was in some way not living up to what they had believed they were going to get. A lot of them saw their child struggling with the adoption in some way. And this was particularly true for children that were in transracial adoptions. And these mothers would often tell me, like, look, I chose it. Adoption sucked for me. I chose it because I thought I was guaranteeing a better life for my child. So to see my child struggling in the adoption, that is, then like, who is this actually for? Who did I do this for? So that was another reason. Or, and they would move on fairly quickly. They might get married. They might have other children. They may achieve stability in other ways. And they look back and they say, you know, those first few years would have been really hard. But I think with a little bit of support, I could have gotten through them. I could have gotten to where I am now. And for some of them, they even felt that the homes that they had a few years later were better than what they would have chosen, right? So a number of mothers chose to relinquish because they're like, I really believe my child needs to have a two-parent family. And a couple of times, that's what they would choose. And then within 4 years, they would be married, they would be raising other children, and the adoptive parents would be divorced. And they would be like, what was the point of this? Like, what are we actually doing here? You know, or other things, like one mother that I interviewed, you know, her child, as he got older, was neurodivergent. And she watched his adoptive parents really struggle to connect with him and figure out how to parent him well, given that. And meanwhile, she had gotten married and her husband has autism. And she said he would have been a great stepfather. And, you know, they're in an open adoption and her son comes to visit and she's like, and they have a great, really valuable connection. And so there's nothing about what happens at the time of the adoption is permanent other than the adoption. Both families can change really dramatically. And so the premise and the promise that is made at the time of the adoption can change so quickly that a lot of mothers become really critical about what they believed they were accomplishing with the adoption at the time.
You interview someone who says, like, you know, just $1,000 would have possibly changed my decision. If I just had $1,000 extra of support, I might have made a very different decision. And that seemed to come up again and again, this like lack of finances and the idea that kind of like classist ideas about who will be a better parent and it really being so much more financial seemed to recur again and again in a lot of the stories that I read.
Yeah. And people have pushed back on that. And like, it takes way more than $1,000 to raise a kid. And like, look, I know. I know. But it's not that they're saying, I need $1,000 to raise this child. I need $1,000 to get through whatever crisis is driving this relinquishment. $1,000 to, you know, have a safety deposit on a new apartment that feels safe. You know, just $1,000 to feel like to buy a crib and a car seat and some diapers and feel like I kind of had what I needed to envision having this baby in my home. Or mothers who are so sick during their pregnancies that they lost their job, that they didn't have any money and that they just needed a little bit of money to kind of get through, get to the next point, right? They don't need to get from A to Z. They just need to get to B. And then they're going to figure out C. And then they're going to go, you know, one step at a time, like so many American families do every day, right? They're going one step, one day, one paycheck at a time. It's just that they need the resources to even get to that point, to get through whatever crisis is making parenting feel deeply impossible at that late point in pregnancy or immediately after birth.
I think the numbers about adoption rates in other countries were pretty revealing, like, you know, that in Iceland, for instance, there was 1 year, like, where I believe where there were zero adoptions. Are you saying like a high year in Iceland of adoptions is 8 adoptions?
Yes. Yes. Well, adoption has a lot fewer people than we do. But even controlled for population, our rate is astronomical compared to theirs. I will say, like, when you look at countries that have really robust social safety nets, like Nordic and Scandinavian countries, right? They still have adoption. It's just mostly international adoption, right? So if you look at Denmark, Danish women aren't relinquishing their children, but Denmark has a lot of international adoption into Denmark from Korea is a large source of children for international adoption in Denmark. But yeah, I mean, any country with a better social safety net is going to have lower rates of domestic adoption. That is true. But I will also say that evangelicism, as in a uniquely robust American institution, feeds into a lot of this. And we can talk about like the survival mechanism, the financial resources, but a lot of the mothers that I spoke with grew up in the evangelical church and had these kind of conservative, aggressive ideas about what family needs to look like. I'm here in San Francisco, you know, so most adoptive families that I know, like parents at my kids' schools or in my broader community, in my personal network, the adoptive families I know are mostly gay parents, same-sex parents, right? In LA, it's probably not that different, right? But we forget in that context that the majority of adoption in the United States is through religiously affiliated agencies. And I think that these, again, conservative ideas of needing a two-parent heteronormative household that will provide a religious upbringing, particularly, this also drives a lot of American adoption. That's somewhat unique to the United States. And look, a lot of evangelicals are trying to make it less unique, but I think that it's particularly at the heart of American adoption.
Towards the end of the book, you mention a movement towards adoption abolition. Explain what that is. And I think of it in terms of also as someone who studied infertility and can see the flip side of the way not being able to have a child can affect people and the struggles and traumas having to do with that, and that adoption, like on that side, adoption is seen as the silver lining for those struggles, you know. So I'm imagining that you've seen this story from both sides. So how do you square the way that adoption plays into infertility or LGBTQ relationships and then this, you know, very real, very valid argument to stop it completely?
Well, I thank you for asking the question about abolition, because when I talk about abolition, and I should be clear, like in the book, my discussion of abolition is rooted in, it's really interviews with advocates that are adopted people, right? People who have been part of this system. So it's not me saying this as a scholar, right? It's a documenting this advocacy that's happening, that's rooted, that's coming directly from birth parents, first parents, and adopted people that are really leading that movement. And, you know, so I got some pushback like, oh, well, adoption abolition, that's just going to take away more choices from women. But abolition is not about making adoption illegal, the same way that the anti-abortion movement is about making abortion illegal. It's about thinking about what it will require to make adoption unnecessary. What it means to keep families together, what it means to provide a social safety net, what it means to make sure that people have the resources that they need to parent the way that they want to, the way that they hope to. And I think that that is actually a really productive conversation, even outside the context of adoption, because we have so many American families that are dealing with housing instability, food insecurity, all these ways that they are made vulnerable, struggling with addiction, inadequate mental health services, like any crisis that any American family can face can make them more vulnerable to family separation, either by virtue of family policing in the child welfare system or targeting from the private adoption industry. So these conversations about how we support families do a lot of good because it's actually going to support more people who never considered adoption, right? Those people so vastly outnumber the number of families that are separated by adoption. So thinking just about how we're caring for vulnerable people and providing spaces of support for them, that's what the abolition conversation is about. It's not about making certain practices illegal. It's about being more aggressive and also creative in how we're caring for families and children. So to me, that is a very reproductive justice-centric effort that I find really appealing. But to get to the second part of your question, like what should people who cannot conceive do by virtue of biology or circumstance or who they have as their partner? And that question I actually can't answer. I have a lot of empathy for people who want to have children and don't have a clear path for making that happen. But I also think that no one is owed a child. And you could be potentially an incredible parent and still you're not owed a child. Nobody is obligated to give their child to you simply because that's what you want. And adoption, and this is sort of like a truism that's oft repeated, like adoption should be about giving homes for children who need them, not about giving babies for parents who want them. And if we're keeping this centered on what children need, and if we are supporting families so that children can be safe and cared for in the families to which they're born, and that's why adoption numbers are low, I think we have to be okay with that. And I think that there are other ways of answering this question, right? Like, how can we make infertility treatments more affordable, more likely to be covered by insurance, right? Like, how can we teach people about their fertility? Like, how can we have more support around that and recognize the trauma and pain there? But I don't know that the way that the current adoption system is practiced, given how premised it is on inequity, given how predatory it can be at times, I don't think that that is the best solution that we can offer people.
I'm wondering, now we're about a year and a half out from the overturning of Roe v. Wade and this idea, you know, reaching the larger population that doing an adoption is no big deal and not an undue burden on the mother. If you're noticing an uptick at all, if the landscape to you is seeming like it's changing, how you're tracking what's happening now, is it any different than kind of what things were like when you were writing your book?
So we actually don't have federal tracking on the number of private adoptions. So it's hard to notice slight or recent changes in the numbers. Most of our adoption numbers statistics are delayed 5 to 7 years, right? Like, it's really hard. Like, as a scholar, I would love to be able to give you a better answer to this question, but it is really hard to know. Some people expected like this massive increase in adoption overnight. And I never expected that because we know that most people who are denied access to abortions will be parenting, right? We saw that with the Turnaway study, you know, so we're looking at this 9%. Who are denied abortion that will relinquish. Now, I also want to be clear, because there are so many people who need abortion care, and because the numbers of domestic adoptions are comparatively so small, even 9% of the people denied abortion could represent a 50% increase in adoption. But numerically, it remains small. You still have far more people parenting than you do relinquishing. But that just means it's going to be harder to observe. I also think that these numbers are going to evolve over time. So if you're pregnant and you are in a situation where you would have tried to get an abortion and you can't get one now, well, you're having a baby. Okay. You can parent one more child. A couple of years down the line, you know, same situation. Now you're parenting maybe two more children than you were inclined, right? And then you have a planned pregnancy. So it gets to the point where maybe your family can hold a few more children than you otherwise would have had if you had had other options available to you. But there's going to be a breaking point where you're like, I can't afford this child and I don't have control over whether or not I'm pregnant anymore. So that's where we go. Mm. And so maybe these effects aren't going to be seen for a much longer period of time. And I think that that's important to understand. So I don't have a clean answer for you. Really wish that I did. but I think that these realities of people's lives are complex. I will also say, Dobbs isn't the only policy change that we've seen in the last few years. We had the child tax credit for part of that window. That is a huge family preservation policy. If you are actually, again, making parenting easier for people, if you have the child tax credit, I don't know the relationship between those, right? If you're doing something that constrains one choice, makes abortion illegal and inaccessible, but you're making parenting a little bit easier, maybe that is preserving families. We don't know the interactive effect of all these layers of policies that are happening and how they are impacting families on the ground.
I guess it's a story we'll just have to keep watching, and I'm sure you'll keep doing the good work.
One of the mothers I interviewed, she's like, are you going to call me back in 10 more years and interview me? And I was like, you know what? I don't know. Let's see how things go. Probably not. But maybe. So.
Thank you so much, Gretchen, for speaking with me today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That was Gretchen Sisson. Her new book is called Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood.
Thanks for listening to the LARB Radio Hour. Subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate us on Apple Podcasts to help us get the word out. And we'd love to hear from you. The producers at the LARB Radio Hour are Medea Ocher, Kate Wolf, and Eric Newman. Our executive producer is Alan Minsky. Our sound engineer is Matea Baim. Editorial production by Jake Levins. Our intro music was written and performed by Imogen Teasley-Vaughton.